Hello everyone, it's Helen here in Truro, here with part one of my podcast on the life and art of Caravaggio. I'll be recording this in two sections. Section one will be his early life up until his move to Rome, and section two will be his early career in Rome up until his breakthrough as an artist. So the break will give you a chance to have a cup of tea or stretch your legs, or you may wish to save section two for another day. Caravaggio was born on the 29th of September 1571. He was named Michelangelo Merisi, after the archangel on whose feast day he was born, but he came to be known as Caravaggio, the town east of Milan where his parents were from and where he spent his early childhood. He was the eldest of four children, to Fermo and his second wife Lucia. He had a sister and two brothers. The younger brother died when Caravaggio was only 16, and the surviving brother trained and served as a priest. Caravaggio's father, Fermo, was a stonemason and a supervisor of building works, higher in status than a builder, but not quite as high as an architect. And it's probable that Caravaggio would have followed his father into this profession. But that was not to be. Because when Caravaggio was only 6 years old, disaster struck the family in the form of the bubonic plague. Not only did it wipe out one-fifth of the population of Milan, but it claimed the life of Caravaggio's father, his uncle, and paternal grandparents. And it's been suggested that it was this lack of parental role model to discipline and encourage him that helps account for Caravaggio's wayward behaviour from adolescence onwards. Now, at my fantasy dinner party that I mentioned in my introduction, the first question I would put to Caravaggio is, when did you know that you were destined to become an artist? Did you discover it for yourself? Or did someone else spot the potential in you first of all? Do you have a story like Giotto's to tell? The art historian Vasari recounts how the shepherd boy Giotto would often sketch sheep he was tending out in the fields with a rock applied to a smooth stone. And one day, the great artist Cianbue walked past and saw the boy's amazing talent and took him on as his apprentice and, well, the rest is history. I like to imagine Caravaggio bored during a maths lesson at school and starting to sketch a cartoon of his teacher. And the teacher discovers the work and tells Caravaggio off, but is secretly rather impressed by the boy's ability and suggests to his mother that he might pursue this as a career. And that's how it all started. But it's just me having a flight of fancy. The simple truth is we don't know. There are no Giotto stories. What we do know is that at the age of 13, Caravaggio signed an apprenticeship for 4 years to an artist in Milan, Simone Petezzano, who claimed to be a student of Titian. Well, he may have trained under Titian, but he didn't have a fraction of the great artist's ability. In fact, the most striking feature of his work was his desire not to cause any offence. And I'll explain the reasons for this when I discuss Caravaggio's religious works in part two and the background to them. Well, Petezzano's work wasn't offensive, but it wasn't particularly inspiring either. And it's hard to see how Caravaggio would have been motivated training under an artist of such limited ability. In fact, there has been a lot of discussion as to whether or not Caravaggio did serve that four-year apprenticeship. One reason for doubt is evidence that exists that suggests he may have spent a year in prison during this period, which would have certainly disrupted his artistic studies. Another is that Petezzano specialised in the field of fresco painting, and Caravaggio never undertook a single work in that medium. Now, it may have been the case because it simply didn't suit his style, but equally, it could be because he didn't know how to. He'd played truant too many times. I take the view that Caravaggio served part, but not all, of the apprenticeship. He stayed long enough to learn the basics of art, how to grind and mix the pigments, how to prepare the canvas, the rudiments of drawing, and that was it. The rest was self-taught. And this was a great advantage to Caravaggio, because with his brain unencumbered with theories about art and artistic techniques, he was free to develop and create new ideas and produce the innovative work which astonishes us to this day. So what did he get up to in all those free days? One theory is that because he was an expert duelist by the time he came to Rome, and boy, did he like a good fight, that he may have served time as a soldier or a mercenary. Another is that he simply got himself into a bad crowd in Milan and spent much of his time getting in and out of trouble. This would help account for his period spent in prison, and also for the fact that by the time he arrived in Rome, he'd spent every penny of his share of the family inheritance that had been finalised after the death of his mother in 1590. But even if he did spend much of his time messing around, I also believe that he spent some time at least studying other art. No artist works in a vacuum, and the most ambitious artists, and arguably the most successful, are those that spend time looking at the work of their predecessors and contemporaries. It's a study that pays dividends, because it enables them to identify qualities in their rivals that they admire and decide to incorporate into their own work, as well as identifying areas where they decide to be different and break new ground. And the problem is that Caravaggio has all too often been given the label of the artist as the outsider, the rebel, who tore up the rulebook on art theory and turned his back on the past. And this image has been reinforced by the story frequently told, which was probably no more than that, of how, when he was in Rome and pointed out work by the great ancient sculptor Phidias and asked what he could learn from this great master, replied, nothing. And he pointed to the ordinary people going about their day-to-day business in the city and said, these are my only teachers, implying that he would take inspiration from nature and contemporary life. But the idea that he simply turned his back on the past isn't borne out by the evidence. Many of his paintings show that he had a clear knowledge of and was inspired by work of the great masters. His dramatic use of chiaroscuro, for example, reflects the influence of the brooding and atmospheric work of Tintoretto. His dramatic compositions, that of the work of Titian. His foreshortening, that of Mantegna. His breathtaking realism in the genre of still life reflects the influence of the Northern Renaissance artists such as Van Eyck and Dürer. The sculptural qualities of his figures reflect the work of Michelangelo. And the bold gestures of some of his characters recall the words of Leonardo, that a painter has to use action to express the passions of the soul. Talking of Leonardo, Caravaggio probably saw his Last Supper in Milan, and he may also have made visits to Venice and Florence. And Andrew Graham Dixon, in his superb biography of Caravaggio, A Life Sacred and Profane, puts forward a convincing argument that Caravaggio had seen and was influenced by groups of sculptures which brought to life stories from the Bible in an intensely realistic, dramatic, and emotionally charged way. These could take one of two forms. The first were single or groups of sculptures found throughout churches in Italy. And a good example of this type was the work of the 15th century sculptor Guido Manzoni, who worked in the highly expressive medium of terracotta. His delightful bust of a laughing child, which is thought to be a young Henry VIII, is in the Royal Collection. One of his most moving pieces is a sculptural group called the Lamentation. This shows Christ, after his crucifixion, laid out on the ground, surrounded by mourners, including the Virgin Mary, Mary Magdalene, and other followers. The gestures and expressions of grief and sorrow of the mourners is deeply moving. We know Caravaggio had seen this work because he did a painting for the church where it resides, St. Anne de Lombardy in Naples. The emotional intensity of this work would have deeply moved Caravaggio. as with the breathtaking realism of another great sculptor, Donatello, whose Penitent Mary Magdalene, which is in the Museo dell'Opera del Duomo in Florence, perfectly captures the profound sorrow and remorse of the grieving lady. And the second type were a series of groups of sculptures which formed part of a larger spiritual experience, such as a pilgrimage site. And the most celebrated of these was the Sacromonte, or Sacred Mountain, outside the town of Varallo in the Piedmont district of Italy. It's a very popular tourist attraction and a World Heritage Site. And it consists of over 40 chapels on the mountainside outside Varallo, containing groups of painted statues by a group of artists dating back to the late 15th century, which bring to life stories from the Bible, from Adam and Eve right through to the crucifixion of Christ. You might liken them to a waxwork display. The figures are disconcertingly realistic, full of life and dramatic gestures and emotions. And the idea is the pilgrim would ascend the mountainside and stop off at each chapel on the way, because these were arranged chronologically, and be presented with a very lively presentation from the Bible. Some could be quite graphic and gruesome. For example, the Massacre of the Innocents shows a very ruthless executioner, hysterical mothers, and dismembered body parts of babies strewn all over the floor, murdered on the orders of King Herod. It's really very shocking, and it was intended to be, because these were all visual aids to a very popular form of spiritual devotion known as visualization. The discipline dated back to the time of Francis of Assisi and his followers, and was later promoted by Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit Church, in his spiritual exercises. And the Archbishop of Milan, Carlo Borromeo, who was Archbishop when Caravaggio was growing up, was a great fan and promoter of this form of discipline. Borromeo was one of the most charismatic leaders of the Roman Catholic Church, and his ideas, particularly on the connection between the visual arts and religion, had a huge impact upon Caravaggio, because the artist's religious works in particular have a strong element of the theatre to them. And he may well have got some of his ideas from Borromeo, because the Archbishop was known for acting out his faith and for using very theatrical and visual ways of worshipping. For example, in times of trouble or plague, he would walk through the city of Milan barefoot, followed by thousands of supporters, all wearing sackcloth and ashes. Penitence expressed through performance art. And spectacles such as these would have made a deep impression on the young Caravaggio. Now, the visualization process involved the believer visualizing in their mind's eye scenes from the Bible. If they struggled to get clear images, handbooks to the process recommended they should substitute people and places in the Bible for people and places they were familiar with. So, for example, Milan could become Jerusalem. Your neighbour could become Christ, or your best friend could become the Virgin Mary. Once you had a clear picture in your mind of the scene, you would then place yourself there and focus on the emotions that the characters in the scene were experiencing. And events around Christ's passion were particularly recommended for this process. So take, for example, the Garden of Gethsemane. You would imagine Christ praying in the garden on the eve of his betrayal, arrest, trial, and execution. You would focus on the range of emotions he suffered that night, his sense of loneliness, abandonment, doubt, fear, and then finally reassurance and resolution. And you would meditate upon the fact that Christ did all of this for you. He suffered death on the cross for your sake, for your sins, and your salvation. So the process of visualization was intended to deepen the believer's faith and strengthen their spirituality and their skill in the art of meditation. Now, if you take the sculptural groups of the Sacred Mountain, underpinned by the visualization process, and compare those works with the religious paintings by Caravaggio, the similarities are incredible. the way in which Caravaggio often takes events from the Bible and transposes them into contemporary times, using ordinary people as models, in order to make the scene more relatable to, more relevant to, a contemporary audience, just as the handbook to the visualization exercises had recommended. The way in which he assembles his characters, like mise en scène, like actors on a stage, in a well-defined space, because very few of Caravaggio's religious works have a landscape background. Most are set in a darkened interior, which he then illuminates, like spotlights on a stage. The way in which his paintings are so intensely real, so dramatically and emotionally charged. Just like the sculptural groups of the Sacred Mountain, so real that the viewer believes they are there, watching the action in real time. And because it is so visceral, so intensely real, they don't just spectate, they participate in the event. They connect with the feelings of the characters and are emotionally and possibly spiritually moved by the experience, which is precisely what the visualization process was aiming to achieve, with the purpose of deepening the viewer's faith. So the truth is that Caravaggio was a revolutionary, but not because he turned his back on art of the past, but because he turned to that art and took inspiration from it, and particularly from the folk art tradition of the sculptural works of the Sacred Mountain, from the emotional intensity of great sculptors such as Mazzone and Donatello, and the spiritual ideas behind the visualization process. And he took all these ideas and applied them to the medium of oil painting. That was his great masterstroke. Therein lay his genius. But this was all for the future. While Caravaggio was based in Milan, it was all a case of just storing up ideas for future use. Because until Caravaggio went to Rome, there is no evidence he undertook any substantial work. I've tried in this section of the podcast to put together a picture of Caravaggio, the artist in making. But to discover Caravaggio, the artist, we have to go to Rome. And that's where I'll resume section 2 of my talk. So this is where I'll take a break. Chance for you to have a cup of tea or stretch your legs. You may wish to resume section 2 on another day. In section 2, I'll be giving a commentary on the painting A Boy Bitten by a Lizard, which is in the National Gallery in London. And I'll also be making reference to two other paintings by Caravaggio. One is The Gypsy Fortune Teller, which is in the Palazzo Conservatore in Rome, and the other is The Card Sharps, which is in the Kimball Art Museum, Fort Worth in Texas. So you may want to have a look at those paintings before returning to section 2 of the podcast. And I hope very much you enjoy your company for that. Goodbye.